طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. East Jerusalem is much in the news out of Palestine these days. The land confiscations, house demolitions, checkpoint humiliations, and restrictive access to the city for Palestinians continues unabated. Today we take a look at the facts on the ground in East Jerusalem through a forum sponsored by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Its president, Laura Friedman, moderates a conversation between Inez Abdel Razek and Munir Nusbey about developments in Jerusalem and their broader context and implications. Inez is the advocacy director for the Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy, PIPD. And Munir is a human rights lawyer, an academic based in Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. Laura Friedman opens the discussion.
So thank you, Inez and Munir, for being here. I'm very happy to see you today. We're here to talk about Jerusalem, and it's, you know, there's no mystery as to why we're talking about Jerusalem today. Jerusalem has been in the news a lot lately. Things have obviously been heating up. We have had recent expulsions and evictions, particularly in Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem. We're having daily protests, which are being met with escalating police violence against protesters. And this includes both Palestinian protesters and Israeli protesters, and also some internationals, and also the media facing that violence. We had the recent brutal eviction of the Salhiya family and the Salem family's eviction, which has now been temporarily postponed but not canceled. In addition, we have extremist Israeli politicians actively creating a conflict in East Jerusalem. We have a far right-wing member of the Knesset who's set up a so-called office in the middle of Sheikh Jarrah, seeming to be deliberately seeking to have a provocation. And we have plans that are continuing across East Jerusalem for new settlements, for new land seizures. It seems to be the Israeli government's plan of shrinking the conflict in Jerusalem appears to be a plan to escalate and increase its activities to really squeeze Palestinians. So with that as the background, lots to talk about. I think I want to start with what's most recently and visibly in the news. So Inez, and you're in Jerusalem, both of you. Inez, can you talk to us about what is happening, and particularly focusing on Sheikh Jarrah and the protests around there? But you're welcome to zoom out further to other things happening.
Thank you, Lara, and good to be with you both today. I think what has been happening in the past weeks is a continuation of the assault and the various different assaults against families in Sheikh Jarrah, but obviously not only in Sheikh Jarrah. I think the media is much more present in Sheikh Jarrah, but there's other neighborhoods that are basically constantly threatened and attacked by a very militarized, border police in Israel, and are eventually threatened of being forcibly expelled, transferred, and these whole areas are eventually, planned to be ethnically cleansed. So I think what has been happening last year and what's, happening today is essentially, one continuation of these different families that face lawsuits by settler organizations that are backed by the Israeli government to claim ownership of the land and houses, and basically trying to, annex these houses and homes and lands.
Thank you. And for anyone who's watching this, I mean, when you talk about things happening all over, if you're watching the news, if you're looking at more carefully, you see that there's daily reports of home demolitions or self-demolitions where Palestinians demolish the homes themselves rather than face massive fines, in addition to Israel charging them the cost of demolishing it themselves. So it's ongoing. Munir, can I ask you to unpack a little bit what Inez referred to, which is this effort to take away ownership? There's been media debate with Israeli advocates saying these are just real estate disputes, right? They're governed by law, and if you're taking sides with this, then you're not respecting the law, or you're trying to politicize what is simply a business real estate dispute. Can you unpack what's actually happening here, and more broadly, not just with these current cases, but with the broader dispossession of Palestinians in Jerusalem, which really dates back to just after 67?
Yes, and thank you, Lara. It's an honor to be with you and with Ines on the same panel. What's happening right now is a continuation of what happened not only after 1967, but since 1948, since what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe. During that big event, Israel displaced 80% of the population in the areas on which Israel was established, of the Palestinian population, the non-Jewish population in the areas where Israel was established. Part of this was the western part of Jerusalem, which was totally emptied from any Palestinian, basically, in the aftermath of the 1948 war. So all the Palestinian neighborhoods in these areas were villages, some of them were destroyed, and some of the houses, the Palestinian families were displaced from there, and instead, Jewish inhabitants have been living in these houses until the current day. Now, in 1967, Israel occupied East Jerusalem, and immediately it annexed East Jerusalem and considered this part of the city as part of Israel, and not only East Jerusalem, that as it was defined in the eve of 1967 war, but additional area amounting to 70 kilometers square of territory. So that's quite a huge area that was annexed to Israel, and immediately Israel started applying Israeli law in that area. Since then, Palestinians have been facing several methods of displacement, moving them from their homes according to many different considerations and reasons and legal justifications. And also we have been witnessing settlements, Israel moving Israeli Jewish settlers into first the area that surrounds the Palestinian neighborhoods. So they actually started new neighborhoods and settlements, in the area of Jerusalem after confiscating a lot of land from Palestinians. Almost one third of the total area of East Jerusalem was confiscated to build Jewish-only settlements in these areas. But what we're witnessing these days is the Israeli attempt to go with, this is a policy that is actually called as such, settling in the heart. And what is meant by that, settling in the heart of Palestinian neighborhoods. So now the settlements that surround Palestinian neighborhoods and surround the city are not enough. This belt of settlements is not enough. Now they want to settle in the heart. And that's why we keep witnessing in the news, but also from the reports of different human rights organizations, whether governmental, non-governmental, UN human rights organizations mainly also, we are witnessing a number of home evictions and displacements based on several considerations. For example, there are many home demolitions that are based on the justification that a home was built without a permit. And the Israeli zoning and planning system since 1967 has zoned the city in a way that only encourages Israeli Jewish population construction in the city, and to a great extent prevents Palestinians from getting permits to build new houses. And when they built without a permit, they get a demolition order. Another justification for demolition is collective punishment, what is known as punitive home demolition. In this method of demolition, the Israeli authorities would demolish a house of a family because one member of the family is accused of breaching their security regulations, maybe through a stone, maybe shot a gun, maybe I don't know what, maybe rammed people with a car and then was accused of a breach of the security arrangements. Obviously, the human rights community calls this collective punishment because despite the fact that they have, in most cases, either punished or killed that person that they accused of breaching their own policies, at the same time, they punish the family by demolishing the house, causing more displacement. But what we're also hearing now, especially in Sheikh Jarrah, and also in certain cases in Silwan, is claims by Jewish settler organizations, right-wing, that they own specific areas of land on which Palestinians are living. And the way this works is that they go to the Israeli courts, they use the Israeli law and the Israeli court system in order to demand the eviction of Palestinian families. The Israeli court system has basically considered these cases and approved, even with little evidence in many cases, the claim of ownership to the settler organizations, and then considered the Palestinian communities families living in these areas as tenants. And now they are being given eviction orders based on the argument that they are tenants. Of course, it is important here to mention that annexation of an occupied city is illegal international law, but also the applying of the occupying power's own law and the jurisdiction of its own courts in an occupied territory is also illegal international law. So if anybody has a claim on a certain piece of land, there is nothing in international law that is against anybody making that claim. Of course, if the claim is fair, but this claim should be made according to the local laws in the occupied territory. So in this case, it should be the Palestinian laws as well as local courts. And in this case, it would be Palestinian courts. But what is equally important is that while the Israeli law allows the Jewish Israelis to claim lands and to order evictions of Palestinians in the eastern part of the city that was occupied back in 1967, the same law does not allow Palestinians who were displaced during the 1948 war from claiming their homes and their house and their lands and all their properties that are in the western part of Jerusalem. So the Israeli law works only in one way. Only one part of the population, only one part of one type of people can make claims, while the others cannot make claims. And this is very unfair. And, you know, I should note here, actually, that many of the families in Sheikh Jarrah specifically, but also some in Silwan, who are living in the lands that are claimed by the Jewish families, Jewish settlers or settler organizations, are actually refugees from West Jerusalem and from other areas in what became Israel in 1948. So these people were displaced. They own homes. And I remember very clearly until today, the lady who was displaced from her home back in 2009, her claim was like, okay, if they say that this land belongs to this Jewish settler organization and they want to kick me out of my house, that's fine. But I have a house in West Jerusalem. Why don't I get access to my house? And then, if there is fair play, let's let it be for everyone. But no. That's not the way the Israeli law works. The Israeli law and court system displaced her again for, you know, for a second time after the first displacement back in 1948. And then, you know, did not care about leaving her homeless during that situation. So I remember the tent that was put in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood back in 2008 and 2009, which Israel eventually destroyed at the end of that period. So this is what is going on. It's a state that continuously works on Judaizing the land, and that's not a term that I am inventing. It's an Israeli term. They say we Judaize the land because, you know, it's a colonial power that functions in this way, unfortunately.
The question, I think, for let's just I want to come back to this because there's a lot to unpack here, but I want to ask a little bit more broadly about the significance of Jerusalem and the city for Palestinians. And obviously, I'm sure most people who are listening or watching this know, you know, the Haram al-Sharif, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, you know, third holiest site to Islam. But Jerusalem has special resonance for Palestinians. And as a Palestinian Jerusalemite, can you talk about that? And Inez, you're on deck because based on what he says, I want to come to you and talk to you about what mobilization of Palestinians looks like in Jerusalem and why Jerusalem is that focal point for mobilization. So if you could go briefly, Munir, and then back to you, Inez.
Yes, thank you. Indeed, Jerusalem is certainly the heart of Palestine. It is the holiness of Jerusalem certainly plays an important role in this. Its holiness to the Muslims, its holiness to the Christians, its holiness to the Jews. All of these three religions have been part of the Palestinian community historically. Therefore, the presence of all these, of all of this sanctity to of the city has played an important role. But that's not only what is there for Jerusalem. Jerusalem has been historically leading Palestine culturally, politically. The eyes of Palestinians turn to Jerusalem historically for leadership. So it is very important for Palestinians. It is heart of Palestine. And not only, of course, Palestine, but certainly, you know, Palestine. People see it as a jewel to them, and they, in all cases, feel that it is the most important factor that would make the big difference in any sort of settlement or peace or negotiation, or because Palestine is meaningless without Jerusalem in a way. It's not about only pieces of land here and there. It's about what Jerusalem represents, certainly for the religious people, but also from the political sense. Jerusalem has been the center of this area for centuries, even before the British Mandate came here. It was always an important city during the Ottoman period, during the Fatimid period, during the Abbasi period, during the Umayyad period, and even before. Jerusalem is Jerusalem, right? And because of that significance, nobody can, you know, can imagine anything going forward without Jerusalem. But also, since the Israeli control over Jerusalem, Israel has been always applying oppressive policies in Jerusalem. And Jerusalem has been the reason for, I would say, all the intifadas that took place in the past, all the Palestinian uprisings started in Jerusalem. Jerusalem moves the hearts of everybody. And therefore, nobody can imagine any peace taking place in any equation without making sure justice is served in Jerusalem first. Thank you.
Thanks. And Inez, talking about the intifadas, the role that Jerusalem has played in the past and uprisings, and also just more broadly about the role of mass mobilization, because Jerusalem is not just special because it's Jerusalem. In the current political context, it's the unique city amongst Palestinians where you have a Palestinian population that is able to access Jerusalem and its holy sites. There's almost a complete absence of the PLO, so it's kind of on its own. And what we've seen in the past few years has been what seems like pretty extraordinary grassroots mobilization and organizing. Can you talk about this a little bit and what it means for Palestinians on both sides of the Green Line?
Yes, I think that, you know, the decades of, I think, all these settler colonial policies and practices and rules that I think Israel has put in place, unfortunately, have also, they've changed, and they are still trying to change the geography, the space, you know, the public space, the private spaces, the landscape, all of this to make it a Jewish city. And I think that's what's sad. It's because I think a lot of the Palestinians feel like it's our barricade. I think it's a barricade. We have to defend the identity of Jerusalem. It's a constant battle to try and keep, you know, the cultural scene, the cultural identity, the, you know, the historical aspects, because, you know, Israel is changing names of streets. They are changing names of places. They are, you know, they have uprooted indigenous trees to plant new forests. They have erased villages to put forests, you know, on top of villages. So all of this has profoundly changed also the reality of the city. So I think there is partly what lives in the heart of every Palestinian and probably a lot of the Christians around the world and the Muslims around the world and the Jews around the world, of like this ideal Jerusalem that we would all want to see, this free Jerusalem, and the reality today, which is a terrible sight. It's a difficult city to live in, you know, and we, you know, it's basically apartheid and settler colonialism in condensed manner. And I think this is where, you know, Jerusalemites always feel this important, this important role that they have to defend their city. And I think more and more because they've been isolated. Again, these policies have made so that there is no Palestinian representation. There is no Palestinian official representation or political representation in Jerusalem. The rest of the Palestinians, most of them cannot come freely to Jerusalem. And then you have the Palestinian citizens of Israel, who we also saw came with, you know, hundreds of people came in buses and so on to also go and pray on Friday at Al-Aqsa and kind of show solidarity. But I think this fragmentation of the space and the fact that the Jerusalemites are being annexed and under siege, you know, constantly, makes it that they feel a special role to organize themselves in the civil society without the presence of the PLO or the PA, and, you know, with any sort of initiative that can, again, defend their city. So whether it's a demonstration in Sheikh Jarrah and maybe a meal in the street and kind of organizing a whole meal for everyone, whether it's, you know, trying to build a bookshop or maintain a bookshop or a library somewhere, whether it's to maintain the theater open and have like actually theater productions coming from Palestine being shown. So all of this is part of, I think, the Jerusalem identity, to try and preserve that identity. And I think part of what we've seen in terms of mobilization and gatherings is also part of that will to feel that, you know, to make sure that people see that we exist and make sure we're not erased.
Munir, I want to pick up on something that Inez just said, which is the word apartheid, which is very much in the news lately with the Amnesty report. And of course, Palestinians have used this word for decades. The world is catching up to this reality. For folks who might be listening who are thinking, well, it can't be apartheid in Jerusalem. Palestinians live there. They work there. You guys are on Zoom. Nobody's stopping you from speaking. I mean, come on. So can you unpack Inez just said that in effect, you know, Jerusalem is a microcosm of the apartheid that faces Palestinians. Can you unpack what that, you didn't use those exact words, but that's basically what you said, I think. Can you unpack what that means and what that looks like in Jerusalem? Briefly.
Yes, indeed. And this is an important question, in fact. The term apartheid in international law means the following. When a state uses its legal system to systematically create a regime of domination of one racial group over another racial group, and then maintains this domination also through the regime and through practices of the regime. When we look at Palestine in general, and I mean Palestine, Israel, the whole, everything under the Israeli legal system, we can see that the system has been, since 1948, but also became even stronger after 1967 and has become stronger with time, has been continuously designing policies and engineering policies in order to change the demographic situation in different places, to keep an upper hand of the Jewish community over all other communities in Palestine and Israel. And Jerusalem is indeed a place where this can be seen in many different forms. So, for example, in Jerusalem, Palestinians are considered by Israel, although we have been here for centuries, my family at least has been, I know, for centuries, and most families have been here for centuries, if not decades, if not, we have been here for centuries, if not millennia in some cases. We are considered foreigners. We are given a residency status. Our children don't get that residency automatically. In order to pass it to our children, we have to go through very complicated bureaucratic tests that the Ministry of Interior imposes upon us. And sometimes we pass the tests and sometimes we don't. And in cases that we don't, we are left with individuals who not only are stateless, because, you know, most of us in Jerusalem are stateless. We have no citizenship whatsoever. But not only stateless, we become statusless, no status at all. So there are people in Jerusalem, thousands of people in Jerusalem, who have no legal status. They live here without anything.
So just to be clear, I, as a Jewish American, could make Aliyah tomorrow and have a passport and legal right to live anywhere in East or West Jerusalem under Israeli law. And your children, born in Jerusalem, and many generations of your family could be denied the right to reside in Jerusalem if Israel deems that you as the family don't, you fail one of their center of life arguments or something, correct?
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. And not only that, if you come as a tourist and get a tourist visa to visit Jerusalem, and you're pregnant, you have a baby while you're a tourist, because your child is a child of a Jew, they automatically become citizens of Israel, unless you go for a process in order to retreat from that. There are slim exceptions for that. So a child of a Jew is born in Israel, is a citizen, even if their parents are not citizens, right? So this is the way the Israeli law works. But our children need to go through complicated tests that sometimes pass and sometimes don't. When we marry someone from the West Bank or from Gaza, there are barriers that the Israeli law has created and developed over time in order to restrict these married couples from living under the same roof in areas that Israel considers part of Israel. Whereas the Israeli law of return gives also the right to Aliyah, not only to the Jew, but to the parents of the Jew, to the grandparents of the Jew, to the children of the Jew, to the grandchildren of the Jew, to the spouse of the Jew. So, you know, the right of return, as it is defined in the Israeli law of return, gives not only the Jew, but also non-Jews around this person, a right to automatic immigration and full rights, as compared to to Palestinians who, you know, we've lived here for generations, and suddenly we are treated as unwanted guests, unwanted immigrants. The Ministry of Interior is a disgusting place that we hate to visit, but we have to visit it once in a while to renew our documents regularly. And this is a place where people are treated very badly. They are always the time keeping documents. Every family does not lose a water bill or an electricity bill or a tax bill or anything like that. You always make sure that you are very organized in keeping years back of all of these bills, because you don't know which Israeli office is going to ask you for evidence at some point in the future. So the Palestinian Jerusalemite keeps walking around with lawyers and with bags of documents in order to simply survive in their city. The Israeli regime treats our political activity and our human rights defense and our cultural activities in many cases as unwanted, at best case scenarios, as unwanted activities. And in some cases, like now, they have declared six Palestinian organizations, including three of them human rights organizations, as terrorist organizations. So the Palestinians are not only unable to practice their culture and their right to freedom of expression and assembly, but also are finding a lot of difficulty in simply surviving in the city. So this is, and also I mentioned earlier, home demolitions. I mentioned how the treatment, when it, some of the areas, right, of the treatment when it comes to claiming your lands back in West Jerusalem versus in East Jerusalem. But then I can go on. Confiscation for public use, for example. In most cases, you will find that Palestinian land is targeted for that, and the beneficiaries of that are settlers. With security regulations, you will find that many Palestinians are given high sentences for silly crimes, while you don't see the same when it comes to the Israeli community, obviously. So all of that will, shows very clearly, and there is a lot more. Believe me, I can talk for hours about different policies and how they are implemented. And these are only, that's the tip of the iceberg that I'm trying to condense in the minutes that I have. But all of that will show how this regime is working in order to keep this domination. And Jerusalem is only part of the rest of the of Palestine. It's separated with a wall from the rest of the West Bank. Our families and relatives and friends and from the West Bank cannot visit us here because there is a wall that so all of that is. And then when you look at the rest of the picture, when you look at the West Bank, Gaza, the Naqab, the Galilee, and you analyze all these as the Amnesty report actually did quite successfully, and see how all of these policies are playing, you will certainly conclude that there is an apartheid regime that is functioning in this area. And the only way forward to peace and to stability and to justice is to start by dismantling this regime and, creating a democracy, introducing, for example, a new principle that the Israeli law does not deal with until today. It's a principle called equality, This principle is taken for granted in the rest of the world. The Israeli law and court system does not take this into consideration. So once we deal with that, then everything becomes easier afterwards, I hope.
I want to come back to Inez and talk about the big escalation last year, which really focused on Jerusalem in the first instance, but eventually became something. There's an escalation between Israel and Gaza, and then we had escalation across Israel inside the Green Line. And that really did start focused on Sheikh Jarrah and the Haram al-Sharif, right? We had during Ramadan and all these sorts of things happening. Can you talk about that? That became what we've heard called the Unity Intifada, where you actually had a unified protest across the whole of the area with Palestinians, Gaza, West Bank, Jerusalem, and inside the Green Line. Can you talk about what that meant and where that stands today? And even connected to what we're seeing in Jerusalem with the at least current efforts by the Israeli government to not have things, or at least seemingly trying to avoid having a repeat of that this year.
Yeah, thanks, Lara. I think I will say that it actually links back to the discussion on apartheid, because I think part of the explanation is this level of control and this system that is, you know, maintaining control over the Palestinians, and then leads to challenges when it comes to organizing. So I think the two really go somehow together. And so I would say that, you know, the youth that you saw really coming out in Bab al-Amud, like in Damascus Gate and in Al-Aqsa and Haram al-Sharif, A lot of these youths, and then the groups that also then started coming from other parts of Palestine, including from Lid and Haifa and Yaffa, converging in Jerusalem, a lot of the why, you know, everyone is going to the streets and protesting or chanting or just be there is also part of that frustration of that growing up under the system where you're born considered a demographic threat or a security threat. And so imagine a young person who, you know, has this, is so angry and frustrated because your life from when you go to school to when your parents go to work is basically you have this, you know, you have Israel and you have the Jerusalem municipality and the Israeli government that control every aspect of your life, and you have zero agency to decide for yourself. You pay taxes. You pay all the taxes to the Israeli government, and you live in a land that's controlled by them, and the services you go to, schools and so on, that are either controlled by the municipality or somehow under the acceptance of the municipality and so on. And, you know, your streets are not clean and not renewed because the municipality doesn't invest in your neighborhood. You live in a ghettoized environment. So you grow up in that, in the sense that you have zero agency, you're not represented. And on top of that, your city is being stolen from you and your, you know, holy sites are under attack. And so I think that what I think triggered a lot is when, you know, Israeli soldiers or the army decides to put, you know, the gates that was in 2017, they decided to put these electronic gates. And now they decided to kind of close the space of Damascus Gate, which is one of the only remaining public space where Palestinians can just go and have coffee and gather and discuss. And this is also stolen from you. This is also, you know, under the control and told like, you're a threat. You're not going to use that little tiny public space that remains for you. And so I think all of that combined with, you know, attacks on religious sites that is always, you know, I think even more emotionally problematic for people, then led to all these I think, disappointing and clearly, I think Palestinian younger generations are defying that fragmentation that has been imposed, and it continues to today. I think there, what happened last year is really the willingness to stop and go beyond that imposed separation of the Green Line, because the Palestinian identity and the Palestinian collective imagination, collective identity has never been about the Green Line. You know, there has been Palestinians in Haifa and Yaffa. You have families from Yaffa who have relatives in Gaza who were bombed. And so, you know, these are the same families. You have some families who were displaced in 48 to Gaza, who became refugees in Gaza and who were under bombs. And so this solidarity is evident because it also comes from family ties. And so I think this is what has been created, that sense that we're all fighting the same thing. Israel has created a sophisticated way of fragmenting us geographically in the space and also administratively. We all deal with our own different things. I'm a daughter of refugees. I deal with my own issues when it comes to papers and where I'm from and my family not being able to return. You have the West Bank people, you know, have certain different hurdles under the military law, and you have the Jerusalemites who are aliens, foreigners in their own city, etc., and Gaza under blockade and complete siege. So everyone has their, you know, has been put under exactly a different way of control to fragment us. And I think people defy that. Now, I wouldn't romanticize, I think, the part of the organizing of all that, in a sense that I think the challenges, specifically because Israel has so much sophisticated control, it's very difficult to kind of organize a movement, because the moment you go out, the moment you start organizing, you are under surveillance constantly. And then, you know, I think the Israeli forces and Israeli government can really come after you. So, you know, I have cameras now outside just my house, and it's all over Jerusalem. You have all these cameras that survey the whole space and can record the voice. The moment you start being, you know, active and kind of meeting a certain kind of people, you can be arrested. And I have friends who are arrested and just can stay a week in detention, and we have no idea why. It's just intimidation, just to make sure they just, you know, don't go further and are deterred from political organizing. So all of this to say that I think, I mean, I wish we had a more organized national movement, but I think it has been crushed so badly. And also the fact that the PA has replaced the PLO and has become this crooked, entity that is basically a subcontracting the Israeli occupation, is not, I think, facilitating that whole coming together of a new national movement. And so that's where I think I would just not too romanticize the existence of an organization, but I think it's these grassroots popular pockets of resistance everywhere that we'll see continuing to emerge in the coming months, in the coming year, in the whole territory between the river and the sea, with people who are ready to defy at the local level, or coming to Jerusalem, or, you know, just more in sync also in the digital space, generally the apartheid and the settler colonial oppression.
Thank you. And for folks, when Inez is talking about surveillance, I think it's worth reminding people that last summer, around the time of the upheaval and the protests, there was a phenomenon where Palestinians in Jerusalem, large numbers, received threatening text messages from Israeli intelligence, which said in Arabic, and I'm reading, "Hello, you have been identified to have taken part in violent acts at Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will punish you," signed Israeli intelligence. And there were Israeli lawyers who challenged that. But I mean, the idea that you're being constantly surveilled is not, it's by no means an exaggeration. And that's, I think, for folks who are, you know, looking at what's happening on the ground, it's important to factor in the constant peril that the Palestinians face, lifting their heads at all in this. I want to come back to you, Munir, and this can be the last question. We're coming close to the end of our time. And I want to ask you to comment on normalization. And this is, you know, if you want to talk about the Abraham Accords or more broadly normalization, but I want to talk about it particularly in Jerusalem, because if you look at some of the visuals, some of the text messages and pictures on social media that have come out, where you have nationals from Arab states that are normalizing with Israel, making high profile visits to Jerusalem, making visits to the Haram al-Sharif. This is then protested to some degree by Palestinians. It almost seems like in the name of normalization, there's an effort to really put Islam and the Islamic identities in Jerusalem squarely in the center, and in a sense break it off from the Palestinian struggle, or make it seem as if the Palestinians are unfairly trying to monopolize Islam as a political move against the rest of the region. Can you talk about that a little bit from the perspective of a Jerusalemite who I assume is watching this closely?
Yes. I mean, look, unfortunately, normalization has been a very sad development in the history of the region. It is, you know, there is a lot of injustice ongoing here. And the traditional position of the regional governments over the past decades has been, we support Palestine, we support Palestinian rights, we will only normalize, that's in, you know, in 2002, we will only normalize when this issue has been resolved with the peace agreement with the Palestinians.
So, and when you say 2002, you mean the Arab Peace Initiative, yes?
The Arab Peace Initiative, and yeah. And, you know, all of these things seem to be, you know, good supporting leverages, I would say, in order to, at the end, reach a final peaceful agreement, regardless of, you know, I don't think that this process was ever going to take us for a peaceful agreement because of the way it was designed, but let's put this aside for a minute for the sake of this conversation. Normalization came at a time that you don't understand why is it coming right now. Is it only because of American pressure? Are there other interests? What about justice? What about the just cause that we have been talking about? You know, we... I'm you know, very surprised and sad to see that these countries are ignoring all the information that they know. They themselves are receiving a lot of Palestinian refugees since 1948 and 1967. And so they know better, actually. And the fact that they just normalized their relationship with Israel was sad. But also, the fact that... this normalization ignores the fact that the city of Jerusalem is occupied and that is it is under this oppressive regime, and that Al-Aqsa Mosque that some of the visitors want to come and visit under Israeli supervision and even with Israeli company somehow and as being the guests of the Israelis, makes it even worse. It is, in a way, in our fear, especially in Jerusalem, that this is some sort of an implicit recognition of the Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem. In fact, why would the Abrahamic agreements mention Al-Aqsa Mosque in the first place? Isn't it outside the territory of the State of Israel? According to international law, it's occupied territory. So why is it in why is it mentioned? Why is it a topic? If you want to normalize with Israel, while I'm not happy with that, but leave Jerusalem alone. Therefore, it really worries me that not only the fact that they are doing this for whatever interests they have, maybe with the US, maybe with Israel, maybe with, you know, that's one thing. But the other thing is when it is stretched further than it should, and when it starts involving holy places like Al-Aqsa Mosque, it becomes much more worrying to us. So I'm very sad, especially now. The world is gradually, maybe slowly, but I'm sure that as time goes by, will gradually more and more understand and then recognize the presence of an apartheid regime. And at the time that we're hoping for this momentum to be built, we can see that there are some countries that are ignoring the injustices completely. And this is worrying us very much. And certainly it doesn't help for any progress of any sort of peace in this region. That's not the way to do it. The way to do it is only by applying sufficient pressure on Israel in order to understand and realize that it cannot continue applying an apartheid regime on the Palestinian people and at the same time expect everybody to be its friends. Because look, Palestinians will not accept to live under apartheid. Regardless of what people say, what people think, you can, you know, we want peace. Nobody wants peace more than Palestinians, that's for sure. This is something, a dream we have. But peace cannot come at the expense of our human dignity. We don't feel that we are less human than any other race or religion or group in this world. And we're, you know, we will not be able to call our silence peace, because that's the way it is being marketed right now. Peace is basically keeping the fragmentation that Ines talked about now of the Palestinian people into small Bantustans with some sorts of self-rule here and there. And the continuation of the situation. And for us, this is not peace. This is a continuation of an apartheid regime that we will continue to resist, whether, you know, even if we are weak and poor and we don't have the means right now to end this, but we will continue resisting it with our words and with our loud voices.
Thank you. And I think the world is paying some attention. And I will say the difference from now compared to, say, 10 years ago, when, you know, protesters, there's video of how Israel is treating nonviolent protesters. There's video of police abusing protesters, taking away Palestinian flags as if it's an act of terrorism to hold up a flag, which, by the way, is entirely legal, even under Israeli law. I do think some of that is changing, and the shift in the recognition of apartheid, I think, is a big piece of that, which is probably why it scares Israel and many of its supporters so much.
We have to leave it there. You've been listening to a discussion of current events in Jerusalem with Inez Abdel-Razek and Munir Nusbeh, moderated by Laura Friedman. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m., and on kkrn.org at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and 8 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you'll get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.